Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices as we come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m. and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we also archive these programs, and we also link to our guests. We'll give you the website for our guests here in just a few moments, and we encourage you to check out the information that our guests have to offer and see what resonates with you, see what fits for you, and take that in a manner of speaking, run with it, and certainly hope that it will benefit you. And if it doesn't, then, well, keep searching. I mean, I cannot believe I'm about to say this, folks. We have nearly 10 years of programs, 52 weeks in a year times 10. You do the math. It's very simple. Nearly 520 programs, probably 519, because I've only missed in the 10 years one show. I was so ill. We were doing the show live, and there was absolutely no way, and I did not have time to pull up a program that had been recorded earlier for initial broadcast. So we had to do a repeat that particular, I think it was on a Saturday at that time. Nonetheless, I'm grateful that you've joined us, and we've certainly interviewed more than 520 people over that course of time. But by the same token, we've also had folks who've come back to join us to share their thoughts, their ideas through the work that they are doing. And my guest today is no exception, Roberta Grimes, who's the author of The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, Liberating Jesus, and, of course, her latest, which is The Fun of Growing Forever. She's also written another work, My Thomas, and we'll be talking about all of this, but in particular, focusing on the whole purpose of this life. What is it all about? And of course, we're always asking that question. And we want to thank you, Roberta Grimes, for joining us on the program again. This is your fourth visit in, quite honestly, 3 years.
Yes, Richard, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me to join you and your wonderful guests and friends.
Well, I tell you, it's a question that, of course, always is coming up for folks. And that has to do with why am I here? And, you know, where am I going? Where did I come from? Those, you know, the universal eternal questions that we are constantly asking down through the centuries. And we sort of kind of, in a way, get an answer depending upon, you know, who we choose to follow or what we choose to believe, what we've read, and so on and so forth. And I've come to a greater understanding, not only in terms of doing this program for the last 10 years, but interviewing for nearly 40, and that is that I think that your explanation is probably more on target than pretty much anybody else's. I remember even asking that question, you know, well, what's the purpose of our existence here? And I remember one gentleman sharing with me that, well, it's to experience joy. That's what it's about. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not criticizing him per se, but it's like, well, if that's it, okay, once we've experienced it, then okay, we can go. You know, I've seen the movie.
Yeah.
I'm leaving the theater now. Thank you very much.
Yes. Yes, it's been fun.
But I think the one thing that I want you to address for us has to do with, of course, again, what you're talking about here, fun of growing forever, and not in terms of a physical growth. We're talking about spiritual growth here, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yeah, the dead are pretty consistent in telling us why we're here. We're here to learn to grow spiritually. And there are bigger explanations than that, which just refine it. But that's, you know, joy is part of that. Learning to experience joy may be part of that. There are many things people think we're here for that are part of that. But the core is that we have, the only thing that exists is consciousness. Our minds are part of the one mind that continuously manifests the universe. And we are here to raise our individual spiritual vibrations as much as we can. You can't do that where we spend most of eternity, because it's like lying around on a spiritual couch. It's too easy. There's nothing to push against there. Mm-hmm. So we come here the way we would go to a gym to get strengthened physically. We come here to get strengthened spiritually. And oddly enough, that's the same thing that the great religious teachers have been telling us all this time. It's exactly what Jesus told us. So none of this is a surprise, really. It's kind of good to see validation coming from so many directions.
But if it's coming from so many different directions, and of course you have focused a great deal of your work on the not only the teachings, but of course the words of Jesus in the Bible, obviously and specifically. And I'm just curious, is it because of your own upbringing that, okay, that's going to be the focus, as opposed to if you had, let's just say for the sake of argument, you had been raised in a Muslim household and you'd be using the Quran and the words of Muhammad, or if you were raised in a Jewish home and you primarily focused on the Torah because there is no other writing at this particular that we know of, or whatever religion you may have been grown up in, that might have been your focus. And in this case, it was Christianity. So it just seems logical. Let's just focus on Jesus.
Yeah. But remember, we plan our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty clear to me that I came in to do this work. I would take your whole hour to just talk about all the validations I've had of that understanding. I came to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose to be a very strict Christian because, in point of fact, the teachings of Jesus are the easiest and most effective way to do what we came here to do, which is raise our spiritual vibration. Other kinds of teachings can do it. I express no opinion about other specific religions, but I do know that some people have been using Eastern teachings to do much the same thing. The problem is they're foreign to Westerners. They seem strange.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm too lazy to learn to meditate or do yoga or chant or get a guru. I just don't have the time.
I hear you.
The teachings of Jesus work with our daily lives, and they work quickly. So they're really the best, I think, for most of us.
Well, I have to say that I can certainly relate to the teachings of Jesus much better than I can others, although I have been studying a wide variety of religions for 30 plus years. When my search began 30 years ago at the age of 17, and I actually started out, believe it or not, even though I have read the Bible cover to cover at least once or twice, my primer, my metaphysical primer, if you will, was Autobiography of a Yogi. And I've read that dozens of times because I have it on audio and seem to be drawn. And it's like you say, I find this interesting, too, that people don't quite clue in on. You made a very clear distinction that, you know, we make a lot of choices before we come into this lifetime. And in terms of certain paths that we may follow, in this case, for example, yourself and even myself, I was born and raised a Catholic in the Western Rite of the Catholic Church. I had exposure to the Eastern Rite of the Catholic Church, which was still under the Pope. People get so confused. Oh, it's Orthodox, Greek Orthodox. No, it's not. Anyway, and so I had great experiences, a great love, and so forth. At 16, I didn't want to go to Mass anymore, and then my mother came to me and said, "Okay." And a years later, after I had married, I asked her, "Well, why did you do that?" She says, "Because I didn't want you to push away," which I never did. I'm not a practicing Catholic today. I don't attend Mass on a regular basis, but I still have a great love. I hear about ex-Catholics for this and that. You know, it's like, no, I'm not ex. I just don't practice anymore. But yeah. I love the ritual.
Right. You don't need to practice.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But I have a great love for the ritual and the tradition and the ceremony. That is just so, I can't think of any other way. It's so cool. I love that part of it. And we've lost a lot of that in our Western culture. It has nothing to do with religion. We don't have those moments in time anymore. For example, in the Jewish tradition, you have the bar mitzvah where the boy becomes a man. And in ancient times, the boy was treated as a man at the age of 13 after that ceremony. And in many other tribal traditions, it's the same thing where the boy goes off, the mom and the daughters are crying and carrying on. Oh, my boy's going. But when he comes back, they treat him as a man. And from that point forward. But in our Western culture, we don't seem to honor that quite the same way, or other milestones in our lives. And I'm just curious because I want to tie this into this whole aspect of spiritual growth, which is why we're here in the first place, and also why we're also trying to. Well, many of us, we want to transform the world, and we can't transform this world until we transform ourselves, which, on the one hand, seems rather simplistic. But at the same time, it's like, that's how simple it is.
Yes,
so
right.
Tell me about the concept, if you will, or the importance, shall we say, of the recognition, the honoring, and the, shall we say, the traditions, so to speak, as we approach these different milestones in our lives and their relevance or lack of relevance, maybe, to our spiritual growth.
There are things which are of man, and there are things that are eternal. I think that, and I know that we all hunger for what is eternal. A lot of that shows up in fear of death, fear of illness, fear of the mortgage payment. Fear is a very prominent force in our lives, and it's the opposite of love. And it's one reason that we feel in such anguish now. And so I think that we see these rituals as a kind of way to touch the ineffable. We know that there's something more, and we're trying to touch it. The more people actually begin to live at a higher vibratory level, the less necessary it feels, which is what happened to you. When you were younger, I didn't need to go to church anymore, but I still, you know, admire and love. I feel the same way. It was the worst day of my life when I finally had to give up looking for any evidence at all that what I had believed as a Christian was real. There is no evidence. In fact, all the evidence goes the other way. And that was hard for me. To this day, I love Christianity. It's just that I found that it's not real, and in fact, it's the opposite of spiritual growth, and that's what made me finally understand I couldn't be a Christian. I had to be a follower of Jesus. That was all I could do. But it's been tough. I agree with you. It's very hard to give up what was our comfort in childhood, and very much our comfort.
Mm. I want to respond to that in terms of your comments about, Christianity versus following Jesus. I struggled when I was working for the Christian radio station with the whole aspect of the position that I was kind of taking was that I shouldn't even be a Christian. Yes, follower of Jesus, but Jesus was a Jew, so I should be Jewish because Jesus wasn't a Christian. Jesus was a Jew, and I mean that was the logical concept for me.
Yes, you're right about that, actually. Yeah, I what I find tragic is that people who claim to be following Jesus are really following the teachings of Paul. And the teachings of Paul, while he tried so hard to be a follower of Jesus, and I bless him for preserving the teachings of Jesus, in point of fact, what he taught was an early first century Jewish sect that was based partly in what he believed Jesus had taught and heavily based in the beliefs of first century Jewish folks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is to this day. That's what Christianity is. If we're going to be honest, and I think if we're going to be anything in this world, what we owe God is honesty on our part. I think it's time for us to, because it's possible now to know the truth, and Jesus said, I think it's good to like look at what he might have said. If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. That's John 8:31-32.
Mm-hmm.
Even during his lifetime, they were starting to build a Jewish cult around him. He said, don't do that. He said, don't put new wine into old wineskins, because if you do, the wineskins are going to burst and the wine will run out.
Yeah.
Instead, put new wine into new wineskins and both are preserved. He did not want us to do what Paul felt he had to do, and he probably was right. He probably had to do it, which was to package his teachings in the old religion. He didn't want us to do that, but we did it. So for 2,000 years, we've been loving the wrapping, this beautiful wrapping. And that's what we've been, that's what the cross is. That's what all of that is. But it's not the gift. The true gift is those gospel teachings. And that's what it's time for us to begin to pay attention to.
I made the assertion to one minister that if the people of Jesus' day had gotten it, had understood what was being said to them, that with the exception of the book of Acts, because it's still more historically oriented, the rest of the Bible, maybe even in maybe excluding the book of Revelations, the rest of the epistles would have been irrelevant if people had just gotten it. Because my understanding is that all the epistles are nothing more than explanations, because people kept having questions and trouble, you know, deciphering what the real meaning of what Jesus had said and had taught.
Yes, and there's no way they could have understood. We only now understand. We could not have understood it before at least the 20th century, and even now we're seeing more truths there. We're talking eternal. Jesus is an eternal being. Jesus knows the truth. He knew the truth 2,000 years ago. But he was talking to people who were, Iron Age, for heaven's sake, first century primitives. They didn't have any way, no matter how simply he put it, they had no way to understand what he was teaching. And the more we now learn and the more we look again at what he said, the more we understand that he's truly an eternal being and he truly came to teach us the absolute truth. But there are so many obstacles to our understanding. For example, when the Council of Nicaea in 325 assembled the Bible, they both took things out of the Gospels that Jesus had said and added some things because they were trying to build a religion. Mm-hmm. And it's easy now to tell what they added. It's obvious. But at the time, you know, for 2,000 years, 1,700 years, let's say, since Nicaea, people have believed when the people who wrote Nicaea were doing it, they said, we want to make sure people follow, take this seriously. So we're going to say we were inspired by God. This is God's word. So many people still believe that those books that were assembled, 66 or whatever books that were assembled by Nicaea, are magically God's word just because the people who assembled them said they were, which is, to me, I've read the Bible cover to cover because I'm a masochist. I've done it at least 6 to 8 times. I'm serious. You got to be to read it all. And I can tell you for a fact that it's not all the word of God because A, it's full of internal contradictions. Mm-hmm. B, some of those contradictions directly contradict things that Jesus said. And we know what Jesus said is true because the dead confirm everything he said that what he actually said. And C, if that were God, if the God depicted in the Old Testament were really God, I think I would just kill myself now because he's basically nasty. Yeah. He's nasty. Let's be frank. He's arbitrary. He gets grudges. He's angry. That's not God. There is a genuine God. In fact, Max Planck, who also got the Nobel Prize in physics in 1918 as the founder of quantum mechanics, he found the genuine God. And the genuine God is nothing like what Christians believed. The genuine God is nothing but infinite, perfect, all-powerful love. That's all God is. And God does not have a body, and God certainly never gets angry with us.
Well, one of the things that I struggled with myself, and a lot of what you've already talked about, was this, the whole aspect of this Council of Nicaea and determining what would and wouldn't be in the Bible. And I have copies of the apocryphal, as they're referred to, scriptures and so forth. And I had two basic problems. Number one was, who set these guys up as the arbiters of the faith?
Yes, they did.
And what was the criterion to determine what would and wouldn't go in? And it was interesting. I remember reading sort of a bullet point list of the criterion. And I remember at the time I was reading the Old Testament, and the question and the one book that I found in the Old Testament up to that point that I had been reading that didn't fit all of the criterion that they had set up to determine what would and wouldn't be canon of Scripture was the Song of Solomon. It just didn't fit. It was about sex. And it's like, wait a minute, I haven't found any references to him talking to God or God talking to him in the Song of Solomon. I thought, wait a minute. And, you know, somebody said to me once, why don't you just stop asking all of these questions and just go read the writings of the founders of the faith? And I said, and of course, most of the people they had mentioned, I hadn't at that time heard of. And so I thought, well, again, who set these guys up as the fathers, founding fathers of the faith? And, you know, and again, what was the criterion to be one of these select few? But then I got to thinking, and again, trying to stay as humble as possible in this, very small s, self-centered. Gee, if I've never heard of these guys, and I'm asking the very questions that they supposedly were asking and answering, then that kind of, doesn't that put me in the same category as them? You know, and so I just, you know, but it's one of those things where each one of us has to, we have to ask the questions. We can't not ask the questions. We would be doing a disservice to ourselves. And I do believe to our, I want to say species, if you will, if we don't ask these hard questions, and which is what disturbs me, of course, about modern day journalism, is I'm not hearing the hard questions. Where's Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes of the 70s, who will show up at your doorstep, knock on your door, and start asking you the hard questions? And the same thing as applies to religion or spirituality. And so I'm really enjoying, and I have to compliment, and it's probably your publisher. I don't know if you had any decision-making process on this. I have to compliment your publisher or yourself, if you did make the decision, on the not only the font, but the font size, because it's so easy to read for me, especially. So it's got to be even easier for other folks with normal vision. It's really cool. The other thing that I found interesting, and I want you to expound on this, especially for those who have not heard you on this program before, are not familiar with you and your works. And by the way, folks, the website, oh my God, it is ridiculously simple. RobertaGrimes.com. How simple could that be? RobertaGrimes.com is the website. But I want you to tell us about the impact of what happened to you at the age of 8 and the experience of light, which was not wasn't the last experience you had, but it was really, I think, the catalyst that places you here and now today.
Yes. When I was 8 years old, I woke up in the middle of the night and knew there was no God, and I was terrified. In the midst of my terror, there was a flash of white light in my room, and a voice said, "You wouldn't know what it is to have me if you didn't know what it is to be without me. I will never leave you again." And of course, when you're 8, everything surprises you, so nothing really does. I thought at the time, isn't it handy if you forget there's a God, they remind you, and I went back to sleep. But because I never asked a question, I never got an answer, and I was so frustrated by the fact that I never figured out what that was, and I never really asked anyone. It was too sacred an experience. I wasn't going to have anyone poo-poo it. Nobody ever who has these experiences ever talks about them unless they can trust you, or so I've learned. But I've actually majored in religion in college, early Christian history, just so finally I would find out what happens when you forget there's a God. This is what happens. Well, I didn't ask a question, never get an answer. And that's what I realized. I'm going to have to figure it out myself. And my entire life has been devoted to that.
Hmm. Well, I have to say that I personally have not had that kind of an experience, or even for that matter, because you make the comparison between the light and the voice that you heard, as well as that of Moses, as well as that of Paul, Saul of on the road to Damascus, then becoming Apostle Paul. And I remember talking many, many times over the years with people about our own intuition and listening to that still small voice. How is that different from the voice that you heard?
Well, it really isn't. There are experiences of light in the Bible. They also have occurred to other people. As I've talked about it, I have heard it's much rarer than a near-death experience, but it's in the nature of that. It's an extraordinary experience in which we are in contact with the greater reality, which is most of reality. And typically it's our spirit guide who is talking to us then. When spirit guides speak to us, they always say, "I will never leave you." And I didn't, it took me decades to figure out who it was, whose voice I heard. But my mother had the same experience. She was convinced to her deathbed that it was God who had spoken to her, and it was the last thing she forgot. She no longer knew us, but she still remembered that experience. So it's very profound. But all of us are in contact constantly with what we think of as the divine in the person of our guides. We all have a primary spirit guide. If there's a still small voice, it's probably your spirit guide talking to you, but there's no difference between your spirit guide and God. God is everything that exists. Nothing else is real. Our minds are part of that mind that continuously manifests the universe. So when people insist to me, "No, I heard God, I didn't hear my spirit guide," well, that's a distinction without a difference. Your spirit guide is the face of God. You are the face of God. We are all part of that one energy, which is infinitely perfect and infinitely powerful. The difference in our case is that we've forgotten who we are. Mm. We're here to remember that, and that's what spiritual growth really is.
How about this? This was an interesting comment made by one of my guests, and I posed almost that very statement that you just made to them, and that was, as far as our evolutionary process, are you telling me, and I'm asking this of my guest, are you telling me that there's going to come a point when we are going to basically remember who we are? And this person's response was, to me at least, it was very interesting. They said, "No, we're not going to remember who we are. We're going to remember who we have always been." And I thought that was an interesting distinction. I mean, how is that different in one sense? But it's like you've just said. And I'm curious as to, you know, Jesus said, "Come to me as little children."
Yes.
And I've often thought about that in the context of, you know, for example, you quoted, know the truth and the truth will set you free and so on and so forth. And I thought, in every instance, that comment about "come to me as little children," not childish, but childlike, with that childlike wonder and awe and curiosity, which I hope that I have been able to maintain throughout my short little 57 years. That, whereas a lot of folks, they come to it from a position of adulthoodness. I know the answers. I know how to interpret the scriptures. Don't question me. I'm the master. And people follow folks like this. And I've never been able to, not that I've really been looking, I've never been able to find a person in this life, in this reality, to follow. Am I missing out on something?
You mean like a guru or something
like
that?
Yeah, yeah. Because so many people have personages that they almost revere. You know, it's like, "Hey, I think Pope Francis is a great guy. I like what he has to say. I like his demeanor, his personality, and all of that. You know, I like Gandhi, and I like this person and that person." But it's not like I'm going to give up everything and put on sackcloth and ashes and follow them the rest of my days.
We are not meant to follow human beings. We are meant to come closer and closer to who we really are, which is an aspect of the Godhead. And Jesus, others do also, but Jesus is the one who most simply says that. He tells us not to go to the synagogue and pray loudly and all of that, because that's your reward if you do that. Instead, go into your inner room and pray to the Spirit, to the Father, to the Godhead, which hears in secret, and that Godhead who hears in secret will reward you. Now, he's talking to first century primitives, so he's putting it in a way they understand. What we come to understand is that the only way for us to grow spiritually is to cut out all the middlemen. I mean, well, that's really what religion is. It's a middleman between you and God. When you are already an aspect of God, anything that comes between you and your ever more perfect understanding and relationship with God, that gets in the way. That's not helping you.
Mm-hmm.
So no guru is going to be of any use to you. No pope, no priest, nobody, no matter how perfect they seem. Jesus is the way to do it, I think, just because Jesus is the easiest way. But there are other ways. But whatever you do, you've got to get everything else out of the way so you can reunite with what you always, as he said, your friend said, what you always have been, which is an aspect of God.
Yeah. This process of spiritual growth, I think, is something that a lot of folks have difficulty with because, again, as I mentioned earlier in the program, I mean, it's so simple. But I remember going through a personal growth program, one of those three nights and a weekend kind of thing, intensive. And, you know, we were always asking the question, why, like little kids, you know, we were always wanting to know.
Yes.
And the response always came back, give up the need to know why. And even if you can't ask yourself the question when you ask the question, why, if you get the answer to that question, how is that going to change your life? I mean, and it was really trying to get us back on track instead of, you know, not that we couldn't ask questions and couldn't be curious, but because people get stuck there and then they don't move forward, they don't grow, they don't advance and
so forth.
They're stuck in all of those questions and that minutia. And even one person told me privately once, they said, why don't you leave some questions left unanswered for eternity and give you something to do?
Well, the thing is, and I say this in the fun of growing forever, the key is forgiveness. Jesus says over and over in the Gospels, the key is forgiveness. And what you've got to do is forgive the need to know that. Understand that this is basic physics. This is basically consciousness physics. When we come to Earth to have an experience, and it's always carefully planned, and we're trying to learn and grow as much as we can spiritually, when we come here, it's just like coming to the gym. When you go to the gym, you put on a t-shirt and shorts, you strip down to the least clothing possible, and you get on those machines, and you work your muscles. Well, you're working your spiritual muscles when you're here, so you strip down to maybe 10% or less of your eternal mind, which is in fact extremely powerful and immense. You will reunite very soon after your body dies. You reunite with who you really are. But you get this stripped down mind, and it's equipped for rapid learning. It has a power, and the power is basically free will. You can choose to do what's going to help and choose to do what's going to hurt, but that's about it. And the rest of it is, it's habitual, it's lazy, and it easily changes course. You rearrange the rocks in the stream and the water at once flows differently. That's all your mind is. It's no more complicated than that. So forgiveness is nothing more than teaching your mind not to have these disruptive things going on. Because we've taught our minds to be upset if someone cuts us off in traffic, to worry about details, you know, why this, why that. We've taught our minds these things, and therefore our minds to have the habit of doing it. And what I learned when I was trying to figure out how to actually do what Jesus said, what I learned was you can retrain your mind so easily. I'm not the first one to figure this out, and I've since learned that other people have other systems that all work, because the key is to distract your mind and make it feel troubled enough by the fact that it got it wrong that it will, oh, it's going to stop bothering you about people who cut you off in traffic. Your mind will easily flow differently when you rearrange the rocks. It takes about 2 months. And if you follow the exercises in the fun of growing forever, that's all it takes, and you are forever changed. Things don't bother you anymore. That's what spiritual growth really is. You're removing the obstacles to love's awareness. That's all you're doing. When everything is forgiven, it stays forgiven, and your mind rises just like a bubble in water, and you start loving everyone and everything. It is so simple. And once you do that, of course, the sky's the limit in terms of how well you can grow, because you've gotten rid of all this garbage that's so distracting in our daily lives. It's amazing how well it works.
And of course, that's chapter 9, that driving is
yes,
is that spiritual experience, that exercise. Now, there was something that really helped me with that, because now I've only been driving since the age of 38, so I've only been driving for 20 years. And I was quite blessed to have a lens implant at the age of 38 to where my vision is now that I'm able to drive. And I remember when we moved to Santa Barbara, didn't have this problem in Phoenix. You'd think I would, but it didn't. I started to get really upset with people who were doing stupid things. That's the way I put it. Stupid things. Yes. And I just honked the horn. Now I don't use the horn anymore. I now flash my lights at someone from behind, if it's from behind or ahead and so forth. At least it's less startling to them, so it's not going to cause them to do something more stupid. But maybe it'll get their attention. You know, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't. But I finally was talking with someone who said to me, look, what you need to understand is that this person in whatever the vehicle was did not get up this morning and say, let's get Richard.
Yes, right.
Okay. They right. did not wake up. And as a matter of fact, all of the people who were of a consternation to you all day long did not collectively, didn't tweet together, didn't go to Facebook and say, hey, let's find Richard in Santa Barbara and let's just cause his life to be a living hell on the road.
Right.
Doesn't happen. It just, they are as oblivious of you as they are of every other person on the road. And so that really helped me. And now when I flash the lights, it is nothing more to get their attention saying, hey, wake up. We had one guy. I actually jumped in front of his car. I was walking at the time. He was about to make a right turn onto a one-way street going the wrong way.
Oh, yeah.
And I jumped in front and said, oh, stop. Because disaster was careening from the other direction.
Yes.
Give us a little bit more about this whole aspect of driving as this, you know, teaching us spiritual lessons, if you will.
Well, it was useful because I was the world's most horrendous, vindictive, nasty driver. I tell stories in that chapter people can't believe, but they're all true. This is how bad I was. Before I, you know, began to actually follow Jesus, I was not good. And what I found as I was trying to actually get things right, and for anyone listening who is younger than 70, you are not too old to start this. It takes just a few months. If you're all younger than 80, it's not too old to start this. But what I found was the greatest exercise we have in our lives is driving, simply because you've got to pay attention, so you've got to notice what everybody else does wrong, so you can, you know, make sure you don't hit them or whatever. Mm-hmm. You've got to pay attention, and yet there's limited stuff you can do to really influence what people are doing. So it's such a wonderful opportunity for forgiveness. It's a wonderful opportunity for love and sympathy and all of the things we're trying to cultivate. And what I've found when I used it as this opportunity to love, forgive, and have empathy, what I found was it enormously improved my ability to learn to forgive. So that's what I talk about in that chapter. If anyone who has to do a lot of driving, which I do, this is, you know, what a gift you have, because you have the chance to do what many people don't do, which is to use it as a central way to learn to love and grow. And it works.
And perspective also makes a difference. When my wife and I took our week-long vacation that took 10 years to get to, we drove from Santa Barbara all the way north to Nevada City, north of Sacramento, and then drove back. And I made the promise to her and myself that no matter what, there would be no deadlines. There would be no timetables that were going to be so tight that we had to rush to get somewhere. We were going to have a leisurely trip, and we did that. And now, as we were driving north, and this was after we had been to Yosemite for a couple of days, we were driving from Yosemite to Nevada City. So we had to come out of the park and over to Highway 99 to go north to Sacramento and up. And we got on the 99 and we're heading north. And this is like late morning, maybe early afternoon. And the traffic started to get really congested. And we thought, this is getting too stressful. So I reprogrammed the GPS to avoid highways. And the next thing I knew, we were driving crisscross through between farm fields. And I got to tell you, it was the best.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because everything was green up there and you saw rolling hills. We did come across a site that I was a little surprised at, and that was I saw these two concrete towers way off in the distance at first. I thought those look an awful lot like chimneys for a nuclear power plant. I didn't think there was one out here. Yeah. And I then, of course, found out that it had been decommissioned. But it was a little bit of a shocker. But it was a beautiful trip the whole way up and back, because there the only stress was, of course, the long drive itself.
Yes.
And we worked very diligently to avoid congestion. Whenever the GPS showed us the red line in the roadway where, you know, it was stop and go, we would get off and zigzag through farm fields or the residential areas around the area. And it was okay, because by the time we came out the other side, the red line was still there, which means we still would have been there. And so we were still moving forward. And that was the key there, is that let's keep moving. Let's not get stuck and stopped for 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes or an hour. Let's find a way, even if it's a detour out of our way, so that we're still moving, you know, there's still motion.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that isn't the case when it comes to our spiritual life and growth.
Yes. You're right. We always have to be moving forward. One point I would just make there is where driving is concerned. I found for me an important key was always to leave at least a half hour early, no matter where you're going. If it's a drive longer than an hour, leave an hour early and bring a book. Because if you never feel stressed, you don't feel the same urgency to make people behave around you, which is when I was my problem before. But yes, people have to be careful not to expect perfection from their own efforts to grow. In fact, I tell people, don't expect anything. You'll notice if you do all the exercises and do them carefully. I almost said religiously, but not religiously. You have to do them secularly. But if you do all the exercises, within 2 months, you'll notice some really surprising differences in you. But don't look for them. Just say, oh, that's interesting. Because you are naturally programmed to grow spiritually. That's why you're here. That's why you're stripped down to this kind of mind. And as long as you're working with the process, it will happen and will happen more and more. It's still happening in my life today. And this is 5 years after I stopped having to do any of the exercises or even try. It's just natural for us. And you stop fighting what's natural and your whole life is so much happier.
I couldn't agree with you more. When we get back from our break, I want to speak. I want to talk to you from the lawyer's mind, because that is intriguing to me. And we're going to do that as we continue talking with Roberta Grimes. Her website is robertagrimes.com. And the book we're talking about in particular is The Fun of Growing Forever. We can't transform the world until we transform ourselves. Frustrating, but true. She's also written The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, Liberating Jesus, and also My Thomas. And we're on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we ask you to stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you for staying with us as we continue talking with Roberta Grimes. And I've always enjoyed our conversations, Roberta, because it takes me into the realm that I thoroughly enjoy, and that is the conversation surrounding not just religion, but spirituality and that which makes us that's who we are, if you will, or who we've always been, if you will. And I've always been intrigued by conversations of this nature. I'm curious as to how much of a struggle it has been or was at one point. Maybe it's not there any further. When it comes to the legal mind of Roberta Grimes in reference to spiritual things, because this is one of the things, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, and I've sort of argued this point with some years and years ago. I've learned never to argue beliefs with anyone. I'll always lose. You cannot argue belief. People believe what they're going to believe, no matter what you tell them. But one of the things that I found fascinating with Christianity specifically, because the people that I was surrounded with back in the 80s and early 90s, they were always looking for ways to prove that their religion was the religion. Oh, we found the Ark up on Mount Ararat. We found this. We found that.
That's right. As if it's relevant.
And
right.
Then I would say, well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Yours is a philosophy, I use that generic term, of faith. So if you have the Ark, the Noah's Ark up on Mount Ararat that validates and verifies your religion, it's no longer a religion of faith. It's a religion of knowing, or a philosophy of knowing. And there's a big difference. When you began to do all of this studying and researching and so forth, was that logical mind consternated at times, frustrated because some of what you found as far as spirituality, at least at the time, didn't make sense to you, and you just had to keep digging and digging and digging? How did you approach that on a mental perspective?
Well, that's a wonderful question. The great thing about going to law school is it teaches you how to think. It teaches you how to do research. It teaches you how to assemble facts. And I knew what had happened to me when I was 8, and then a more limited version happened again when I was 20. I knew it was real. So I knew there had to be real stuff behind it. And what I wanted to do was to get beyond all this religious stuff, which I knew I couldn't really trust. And I found eventually that we have a great store of communications received by people we used to think were dead through deep trance mediums in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So the core of my research for more than a decade was done communications received before 1950, because I figured those were going to be naive. They were going to be genuine. Nobody was trying to make a buck with them. And there were, in fact, very serious researchers working with them back then. And I read all the books of theirs I could find. And the great thing, and what really inspired me, was the fact that they all went to the same place. They had different stories. I never saw two that were alike, but it was the same process, the same physics, the same things that they do there, the same way they travel, the same way they communicate. Oh, everything was the same. Nobody had a different story. I say in The Fun of Dying, it was like reading a century's worth of accounts by people who had been to Fiji. They all had different experiences in Fiji, but it was the same place. So that's what inspired me. And what I have continued to find to this day is that if you always are determined to find the facts, you'll find the facts. And there's no ambiguity. It is all right. The physics was especially hard to grasp. The fact that they could travel an infinite distance in an instant was a little confusing, and the way they communicated and all this stuff. But then in the early part of the 21st century, we started to get Quantum Physics for Dummies books, and then it made all made sense. Quantum physics turns out to be what amounts to a plug between the greater reality, which is most of reality, and this level. That's all quantum physics is.
I know that I used to get very frustrated when any of my guests would put quantum in front of whatever it was that they were talking about. I'm thinking, oh, come on, what's wrong with regular physics? Or why is this quantum instead of, it's like the quantum fun of growing forever.
So right. Yes. Sorry to pull quantum rank on you there, but in point of fact, I never even took regular physics, not even in high school, which was good because I didn't have to unlearn a lot of stuff.
Yeah, really.
But to this day, physicists are so caught up in materialism, even though they know nothing at this point. All physicists understand that there is nothing solid. Max Planck said it, and also Albert Einstein said it, and they said it many decades ago. And I kind of trust them over, you know, your average physicist. But it all comes together. It all makes perfect sense. We are discovering the details about a greater reality, which even physicists understand is most of reality. They tell us the part they study is less than 5% of what they know exists. So, we're all on the same page. It's just that they refuse to look at more than their particular paragraph. That's the difference.
Yeah. I jokingly say that science, that as human beings, and then when it comes to science, We think, let's just, again, for the sake of argument, there are 10 billion laws to the universe, all right? And man has discovered 10 of them and says, we know it all now. And then suddenly number 11 comes along. And
right.
okay, so now there are 11. Okay, now we know it all. And then 12 comes along and so on and so on. Or there's physics and then there's quantum physics. I'm waiting for the next level of physics to come. And I didn't take it either. I am lucky that I have a modicum of a grasp of how the universe is staying together in one piece. I'm lucky if I have even a grasp of that concept, let alone the depth and width and breadth of a physicist. But I have to say that I had a guest on the program who actually talked about this. It's fascinating, where he took the three dimensions, height, width, depth. He says, I can prove to you the existence of the first, second, and third dimensions. No problem. He says the fourth dimension, which is time, I can show you a representation of it, but I cannot prove its existence. And then he began to describe the fifth dimension. And his description caused me to have us stop in the middle of our walk from lunch. And I said, your description of the fifth dimension is nothing short of the description of God. And he said, exactly. But see, I can't prove that either, but I know that it exists, he says. And he was, and still is, as far as I know, a physicist.
There are many physicists who understand much more than they will say publicly. Because as I say, way back 80 years ago, Max Planck was talking about all of this, and he's their big hero. He and Einstein both talked about this. The problem is that around the turn of the 20th century, maybe between 1910 and 1920, there were so many good books coming out where people were studying these mediums. And the scientific community was still dealing with quantum physics. They couldn't get their minds around that. They didn't want to have to deal with the dead. So they, at that point, when I say they, I mean the peer-reviewed journals and the university departments, established what they called the fundamental dogma of science, which was materialism. We will study what's material. You study other stuff. And that was established 100 years ago. And you can see it in print back then. They're too embarrassed to say it now. But to this day, they follow that. And young physicists, I'm told, are told when they begin their study, if you want to study this stuff over here, don't bother to get a degree because you'll never get a job. Isn't that pathetic?
Very much so. Very much so. I also find it sad in this day and age, when we have reached a point in our society where we can't converse about these kinds of things for fear of any number of actions or reactions by other people, both verbal and physical, let alone around the world. I mean, you know, it's really unfortunate. Now, here's the other element of this in that regard. Someone shared with me not too long ago, Roberta, and I want your perspective on this. You said that we come into this world with, i.e., a contract, right? A list of things that we're going to do in this lifetime. Or at least we hope to.
I think of it as a plan, but
okay.
It's a deal we make with our guides and just general.
Okay. And if that's the case, and an individual is doing that, but it is what we would judge, because I can't think of any other way of putting it, as antisocial, man's inhumanity to man, and there are many examples of it just in the present day, let alone in the last 200-300 years and the existence of man in general. But if that person, how do we know that that person isn't, hasn't chosen to live that kind of a life to learn whatever it is that he or she is supposed to learn. But unfortunately, for the rest of us, we have to cope with the stress and distress of their actions.
Well, we're told that there are certain things that are never planned. Doing harm to other people is never planned. Being in a place where we have the opportunity to choose not to do harm to other people, that is a plan. But if we make the wrong decision and we actually start doing harm, we are harming ourselves. So, for example, I don't know very much about Hitler, but I'm told that Hitler came in with minor temptations, but his primary goal was to improve his art. Who knows if that's true?
Yeah.
But that's the kind of life where someone basically has gone off the rails. They made a few non-loving decisions, and that those non-loving decisions led to horrible things for a lot of people. But being the Führer who, you know, tried to destroy a whole race of people, that was not part of anybody's plan.
Okay. So that's where an individual has, as I like the term you've used, gone off the rails, has decided for whatever reason that I'm going to do this instead of the plan I came in here. They've basically forgotten. They've forgotten the reason why they came here.
We've all forgotten. I mean, that's part of the deal we make. Because many people will say, well, if I've lived all these lives, why can't I remember them? Part of the deal we make is amnesia. It's not perfect. It's possible to recall those lives. And many small children do have those memories from before birth. But it's part of the deal. We won't remember because then we will take our lessons seriously. I mean, if you knew when you were in school that you were going to get A+ no matter what you did and that you were infinitely loved and you were going to get milk and cookies no matter what, you wouldn't bother, right? Doing hard stuff. So we forget. So we'll take it seriously.
Yeah. Well, I know, too, that for myself, I came to the conclusion many, many years ago that my life had meaning. I don't know why I believe that, and it is a belief. I could say I know it, but only I know it, and so for others it's more of a belief. Because I look at it from the perspective that if my life didn't have meaning, then it wouldn't matter if I walked out of this building and raped, pillaged, and plundered my way down to the beach and back again, because it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. This was all an accident, and it doesn't matter. It's, you know, when I die, lights out, and there's nothing else. But there's something inside of me, inherent within me, that says that's not true, that my life does have meaning.
Yes.
And I'm curious as to your understanding, your awareness of why that is true. Is there a way for us to define or to locate? I think they've tried. Although I have seen studies done of pre and post life corpses, where they weigh the person before their death and they weigh the person after, and they've actually lost like a third of a pound or something like this. And it's like, well, gee, where did that go? What was that? That they say it was the soul that's left the body. Well, I wouldn't think that the soul or the spirit would have a weight to it because it's non-material. But what about that aspect of that spark inside? How do we... Can you help us to understand how we would know and why we would know, and as opposed to those who don't?
Well, we come in, that's actually two questions. The first is we come in with a hunger for more. Just as a baby is born hungry, so we are hungry. And I hear from people all the time now who feel the hunger, but they aren't sure how to satisfy it. And the way to satisfy it is with spiritual growth. That's what that hunger always is for. Some people go very wrong in trying to satisfy it with material objects or whatever, but that's a hole you never can fill. But you can fill it with spiritual growth. But on the other hand, when it comes to the relationship between the body and what we think of as the spirit, in fact, people can see the spirit leaving the body. It looks like smoke, which quickly disappears. You can find on the internet someone trapped a mouse, and you can see it rising from the mouse. It looks like a little gray mist, and then it disappears. There are photographs also of people having to catch it with people. The reason you can see it is that it's not much higher in vibration than the body is when it first leaves, but it very rapidly rises in vibratory rate, and that's why it seems to disappear. But people who are somewhat psychic can see what happens next, which is it reforms into what looks like you, only maybe younger, and it's still attached by the silver cord, which psychic people can see, still attached to the body. And curiously, it reforms naked, and you go, whoopsie, and you immediately, your mind thinks clothing, and then you have clothing on. But this is all real. I mean, if there ever was a skeptic, I'm that skeptic, because I knew there was something real going on, and I wouldn't take anything less. It took me a long time to be absolutely convinced that all of this was real. And that sort of happened about 10, 12 years ago. Since then, I don't have any fear of anything. When you once really get that you are eternal and nothing is going to change that, you lose all fear. Every bit of every fear you ever had is gone.
Wow. What a solution.
It's the only solution, really. Jesus said, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And that's true. He's exactly right.
I remember, to that point, I remember, and this was more of a mortal material question. I remember reading about crucifixions and the way that they were carried out in the days of Jesus and after. And that in particular with Jesus, I remember reading where the final indignity that was thrust upon him was that he was stripped naked on the cross. Now that is my, from what I recall reading. And all of the crucifixes that I ever saw were, of course, he had a loincloth. And I remember going to the Monsignor of the Eastern Rite of the Catholic Church that I was attending because of my first wife, whose family, her father's father came over from Russia literally the night before the Bolshevik Revolution. And I remember asking the Monsignor, why? Why is it that if the truth, you know, you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free, in terms of being honest about the realities of what is our faith, why do all the crucifixes with Jesus have loincloths? And I was actually taken aback by his response. He didn't deny that that was the truth, that Jesus was naked on the cross at the end. What he said was, well, we don't want to upset the sensibilities of the public. And I thought, wait a minute, if you're unwilling to tell the truth about his attire on the cross, then what other things are we being lied to about or not being told about?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You're right. You're perfectly right.
You know, and by the way, if I were to be branded with a giant H on my forehead, I would wear it proudly as a heretic.
Yes. Oh, I passed that a while back.
Because the reality is that it took me 5 years. Once I started to research it, I started to ponder it and so forth. It took me 5 years to release the concepts and the fear of any connections with hell and the devil, Satan, Lucifer. Now, I accept the existence of Lucifer as the creation of God is one of the archangels. But see, I and this is my logical mind, Roberta. If when Judgment Day comes, if in fact that is a real event, and I stand before the Creator again, then my response to that query about, you know, living my life and so forth is, okay, I did the best I could with what I had. Okay. And you're going to do with me whatever you're going to do with me. And I have no control over that. But let me put it to you this way, Lord, you created all of this. So this is on you, not me, because you set all of this up. And that's one of the things that has always gotten me, especially when it comes to this concept of original sin, Adam and Eve and eating of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and so on and so forth. And I love this wonderful poem that I read years ago. I believe the author's name was, I think it was Sebastian Tiberius or something of that nature. Anyway, the poem, I will paraphrase, says, you know, hey, you know, we're a little concerned, the gods are, about man. He's starting to get curious about where he comes from and where he's going to and these kinds. And, you know, he's getting close to the truth. We need to hide that because if, you know, we're going to be out of jobs if man finds out what's really going on here, the truth. So they start debating as to where they're going to hide the truth. On the mountaintops. No, he'll find a way to climb it. Dip in the depths of the ocean. No, he'll find a way to get down there. This place and that place and the other place. And finally one chimes in and says, I know where to hide it. We'll hide it in his heart. He'll never look there.
Hmm. One of the many things that make me comfortable with the truths that I have learned is the fact that the Gospels reveal a lot of this. But since that's a pretty safe place to hide the truth, I think, from Christians, because they apparently never read the Gospels. Mm-hmm. We know that God has never judged anyone. Jesus has never judged anyone. And it says that in the Gospels. Here are two passages from John. For not even the Father judges anyone, but he has given all judgment to the Son, so that all will honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. John 5:22-23. Why did they never read that? There goes the whole notion of sacrificial redemption, which is the scariest part of Christianity. God doesn't judge us. Okay, but Jesus does, right? No. Jesus says, if anyone hears my sayings and does not keep them, I do not judge him. For I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. John 12:47. Save the world from what, Jesus? It's pretty obvious. From ignorance. And that's the only part that we have not allowed him to fulfill. Once we start actually listening to Jesus, he will save us from ignorance as well as he could ever save anyone from anything. This is why it's so frustrating to me, because Richard, it's all there, mm-hmm. except people ignore it. Because the easiest part of Christianity is the get out of hell free card. Now we know there's no hell, we know there's no devil. It's not possible by the physics of consciousness. But still, people would rather keep the card than know the truth. That's what's so upsetting to me about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can agree with you on that. I truly can. It's just amazing to me that when given the answer, I mean, we're always looking, we're always asking the question, looking for the answer. And it's like, for whatever reason, fear, I don't know. Unwillingness to accept it from this particular source versus that one, the answer's right there. We won't receive it, let alone accept it. And I can appreciate your frustration. I want to talk a little bit more before we wrap up here about perfection. Now, in the Gospels, it is said, I believe it's Jesus who says, "Be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." And I did a search, because at the time there was this debate about right and wrong, good and bad, and, you know, good and evil, and so on and so forth. And I'm reading this passage, and of course they're trying to make the connection between good and evil and being perfect. Perfection being, you know, good versus evil. And I thought, well, wait a minute. God is neither good nor evil. God just is. I am that I am. So be perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Said to me, just be who you are. It's not about being good or bad. Your comments?
It's actually about perfect love. We are here to raise our spiritual vibration away from fear and all the other things around fear, like hatred, anger, and all those things, and toward perfect love. And the more you approach perfect love, the closer you become to the perfection that God is. The Godhead is the very highest possible vibration, nothing but love. And that's what it's all about. I mean, if you study the physics of consciousness and you also study the Bible, it becomes pretty obvious. I mean, he keeps saying things like, it isn't enough just to love, you know, those who love you. What reward do you get? It's not enough to love, you know, the people who love you back. But you have to love the people that are least lovable. Love your enemies and do good to those who persecute you. Mm. That's the goal, for us to love our fellow human beings so much that no matter what they do, we will love them. and most the most unlovable, perhaps most of all. Jesus says, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And the second command is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. He never says as if he were yourself, does he? He says, love your neighbor as yourself. And the reason is he knows your neighbor is yourself. Mm-hmm. This is all what this is what we're here to learn and to discover. And the growth that we are to make here is nothing less than perfect love. That's what it's all about.
Mm. One other thing that to that point, I've often made the comment regarding that passage, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. And that is in terms of extending that love your neighbor as if you were the neighbor. Why wouldn't you treat yourself with the same kindness? You know, and unfortunately,
that's
what happens, right?
Yep.
What happens in our lives, and this is why a lot of people go into therapy, is that they don't know even how to love themselves. And we're not talking about a selfish, self-centered love, just about being, I mean, I hear more people on the radio, especially on the radio, talk show hosts, constantly in the mode of self-deprecation. And I'm just sitting here going, stop it. I can't stand it. You know, would you say those kinds of things about your mother, about your brothers and sisters, about your closest friend? Of course not. Then why are you saying that about yourself? I mean, I know my shortcomings. I know what they are. But I'm not going to sit here and belabor them.
It's very important that everybody listening understands that you in particular are the best beloved child of an infinitely powerful Godhead. You individually, you, whoever you are, all the flaws you think you have, God does not see. God loves you in all your perfection. And that's what you're striving to do. You're striving to reach the perfection that God already sees.
Hmm. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today, and I look forward to another opportunity to continue our dialogue. You've done some not only incredible work as far as research, but also you've made reference to a lot of things that most people would say, hey, wait a minute, Roberta, there's nothing in the Bible about that. There's nothing in the Bible about spirit guides and psychics and all of these other attributes of the metaphysical world, that woo-woo stuff from the New Age, from the 80s and the 90s, blah, 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 blah. And I remember getting a call from someone. I used to produce a program called the Radio Family Rosary Program. And I remember doing some research into it. And I got a call from someone who just was blasting the program. I said, hold on, stop, wait. Do you know that every word in the rosary is found in the Bible? Those prayers? And what's the difference between you're asking Mary to intercede for you, and you're asking someone in the physical world, your mother, father, sister, brother, pastor, to perform intercessory prayer. How is that different?
The reality is that every religion seems to have a piece of the truth, mm-hmm. but there is actually an objective truth, and it is discoverable. And Jesus called upon us to search for it. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be open to you. Mm-hmm. He calls us to do this.
Yeah.
And no, it doesn't say in the Bible that it's you shouldn't consult with spirits. It says try the spirits to see if they are of God. Mm-hmm. And every good medium I know does exactly that. It is frustrating, you're right, sometimes because there's so much ignorance, and that ignorance is a shell in a prison. The truth is so much more wonderful than any religion has ever told you. You are the best beloved child of an infinitely powerful Godhead, and nothing ever can harm you. Your life is eternal. By definition, you never began, you never will end. It's all good news. People shouldn't be afraid of it. Jesus calls us to look for it.
Yeah. I'll actually leave this particular point on this note, and that is that when talking with someone, and I used to hear the sermons on the radio that were just unbelievably appalling towards the human being as this lowly worm, this vile creature.
Yeah.
This, and I thought, wait a minute, hold it. You're telling me how terrible and disgusting I am because of original sin, but at the same time, you talk about Jesus dying on the cross. Now make up your mind, because I look at it this way. If we had no value, then why would God have sacrificed himself on that cross if we had no value? So I look at it this way. I'm priceless.
You are. You are, Richard. That's for sure.
I've heard that phrase in many different contexts, too, by the way. And I take them all, but we have fun with it nonetheless. Roberta Grimes, thank you so much. This has been a joy. I can't tell you how much I have thoroughly enjoyed talking with you and delving into a lot of these areas. We could go on for a long, long time about all of these different things, and we'll have you back again. And again, as I have probably reiterated, if you ever find yourself here in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue our conversation on all of this fun that we're having.
It would be wonderful. It's so good to talk with you, Richard.
And then I have three questions I'm going to ask you. I probably asked them of you before, and maybe I've even changed some of them since the last time you were on. But again, thank you so much for sharing so much time. And also let our listeners know about the website, robertagrimes.com. That's robertagrimes.com. And of course, the latest work is The Fun of Growing Forever. We can't transform the world until we transform ourselves. Forward by Jack Canfield. So pick up a copy, go to the website and investigate. I think it would do you a world of good. Roberta, before I let you go, first of three, who is Roberta Grimes?
I'm your best friend. I'm trying to do whatever I can do to make your life perfectly happy and perfectly successful.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I would like to help the entire world come to a place where we have no more wars, we have no more negativity at all, and we live in perfect love. We pray for that in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And Jesus tells us that if enough of us will follow his teachings, we will have the kingdom of God on earth.
And what is your life's purpose?
Oh, that's probably would take too long to explain. I'm only coming now to understand it. But my primary spirit guide and I made a deal before I came into this lifetime that he would guide me through the first part of my life, and I would give him the second part, and that's the part I'm doing now.
And I think you're doing a great job, and I encourage you to obviously continue in it. It's an education for me, and I certainly hope that it is for those who are listening as well.
Thank you, Richard.
Again, Roberta Grimes, my guest, and the latest work is The Fun of Growing Forever. We can't transform the world until we transform ourselves. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.